Well, it is a great pleasure this week to interview Henry Jeppesen. And Henry, I think although we met at the Lampeter reunion just a few weeks ago, our paths must have crossed in 93 to 97. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So you did it. So tell me what you did when you were an undergraduate at Lampeter.
Oh, I did a single honours degree in Swedish, of all things.
Oh, wonderful. Now, it's funny you mention that, because when I went to Lampeter, I was a couple of years ahead of you.
Yes.
There weren't many, but there were enough to sort of, you know, raise an eyebrow and say, ah, you're doing Swedish as well. Because there was, you know, it was a wonderful place. Lampeter was obviously very sort of west, very removed, sort of very
yes.
in a Welsh market town, kind of split, cut off from cities and not from the sort of backgrounds that many of the students would have grown up in. But in your case, you went there to do Swedish, and I found that really fascinating. Do you have any family roots that are Swedish?
Well, my father was Danish. So I had a Scandinavian background, and when I was at sixth form college, Mum said, "Right, you're going to university." And I thought, "Okay, I'll go to university." Then I thought, "Well, what can I study?" And I thought, "Well, languages were my best subjects at school, French and Latin." And then I thought, "Well, I was doing French A level at the time; it's really, really difficult." So I thought, "Why not do a Scandinavian language because of my background?" So me and Mum went up to Hull, where they did Scandinavian studies, and then University College London. And I also applied to UEA in Norwich, near to where I'm from, but that I got rejected. But I wasn't too bothered, because at the time I really hated my. I'm from a small town in Norfolk called North Horsham. I did a few inter-year football, but Lauren Hemp, one of the Lionesses, is from the same town. So I thought I was briefly considering applying to Aberdeen, Chris, because I was as far away from Norfolk as you can get in this country. But I didn't have the grades, so I went on the new entrance conference to Lampeter on my own. And I fell in love with the place, particularly the union, because the union was mad. I loved the union so much. So an integral part of my time there at Lampeter. And I thought, well, and they had a Swedish department, but you couldn't do Danish and Norwegian there. So I thought, well, Swedish, Danish, mayor. So I don't think my dad was too disappointed me learning Swedish instead of Danish, but that's how I came to study Swedish at Lampeter. My A-level grades were very bad, but they let me in anyway, so...
Well, but also the story that you're telling there is one that I've heard so many other people tell as well. And in some cases, I've known people who've said in geography is one very good example. So they didn't get the grades they wanted at A level, so nearly didn't go to university at all, had never heard of Lampeter in some cases, but ended up not just going there, but thriving and then following an academic path in some cases. So in other words, it wasn't just that they got into a university to do their degree, but if it hadn't been for that opportunity, they wouldn't have ended up pursuing the career that has defined them. So
that exactly
was really good in that way.
Yes.
I think Kate Adie as well did, not at Lampeter, but I think she did a degree, if something like Swedish. I think she did it in Newcastle.
Oh, really?
But yeah, so again, you know, a very sort of distinctive a degree to do. And did it entail, I'm guessing, because you were there for 4 years, you had a year abroad?
Yes, I my third year of my degree I spent in studying at the university in a city called Linköping in southern Sweden, roughly halfway between Gothenburg and Stockholm, roughly. And one of the reasons, there was 11 of us in our year who went to who graduated Lampeter with their degree in Lampeter at the end of our degree. So there's 11 of us who went to Sweden, and I thought some of us went because they were doing joint honours in other subjects, and there's three people who also went to Linköping who studied joint honours Swedish and French, and they had a very good French department in Linköping, which is why they went there. But I thought, well, I want to see lots of gigs when I'm in Sweden, so we didn't have an agreement with Stockholm University, so Linköping was kind of the closest to Stockholm.
Did you get to see lots and lots of gigs?
I didn't know, just a few, a lot of gigs in the student pub on campus. But no, I didn't get to. I'm really into Tori Amos, and I was still into Tori Amos, and she did a tour in 1996, and then the closest she played was Copenhagen. She didn't play in Sweden, so I didn't get to see her. But I got to see her at the Albert Hall a couple of years later twice. So.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because if you're that close to seeing somebody, you rather than say, oh well, it's not meant to be, you know, surely you go the extra mile.
I should have gone to, maybe I had a lot of work to do, you know, coursework and stuff at the time, so but
Roxette, were they also Swedish?
Yes, they were. Yes,
Yeah, because that friend of mine, I know that the lead singer there was quite unwell and sadly passed away not too long ago. But
Very tragic news.
she went round the country, I think, seeing Roxette perform as many times as she could. Not in Sweden, admittedly, although the friend I'm thinking of does often travel around Europe to follow particular bands that she's interested in. But Lampeter, of course, itself had a really good scene because it was, of course, it was a bit remote, but and it would have been just before your time. But in, I think it was the summer ball at the end of my first year, so that would have been in 92, so just over a year before you started there, we had Kirsty MacColl performing a set. So it's one of those sort of things that you remember because the artist, because we're used to going the extra mile to see an artist perform, but when the artist has to go an extra mile to perform for our benefit, then it, it's one of the more memorable events. So that again, I think, is also part of Lampeter's charm.
Absolutely. I saw Doctor and the Medics and Zodiac Mind Warp at Lampeter. And the guy from The Alarm, was it Mike Powers? And lots of other bands whose names I don't recall. Well, I was actually in the Ents committee in my second year, Chris, and some of the other Ents people were saying, oh, we should get Oasis, we should get Blur. And I thought, we've only got 1,000 or a couple of thousand. Yeah, they're not going to come here. So I was more realistic, but the other people on the Ents committee were less realistic. Needless to say, we didn't get Blur or Oasis here, but I did see Blur at Marlene Greyhound Stadium. His name was Justin Horton, who was the Ents secretary in my second year. He organised a trip to go and see Blur at Marlene Stadium in East London, and I went. And it was very tacky, Chris. They had these big hot dogs and beef burgers props hanging from the lighting rig.
Do you know, you've just reminded me of some of the things that went on in those days at Lampeter, because it would have been maybe at the end of the 90s, maybe even actually in 2000, because I stayed there for quite a few years, and we actually had the Crazy World of Arthur Brown. And it was one of those sort of bonkers moments, because it was quite, it was like a Tuesday night when the bar was open until 1 o'clock. And because I grew up, with a huge sort of, radio obsession, that of course I was familiar with his song Fire. And he was there, and some people were saying to me, oh, we've got Arthur Brown coming tonight. And I jokingly said, not the Crazy World of Arthur Brown. They said, yeah. And I said, no, I was joking. And they said, no, it is the same one. I thought, what? And I said, so what's he been doing all this time? Because this would have been, 30 years on. And somebody said, admittedly, I should have checked this out before saying what I'm about to say, but somebody said, apparently he went away and did a philosophy degree. So quite apt that he would turn up in a Tuesday night bar with all the philosophy students. Maybe that was the highlight or not of his career. But you did Swedish at Lampeter. And I like the idea, actually, that it wasn't somewhere that you expected to go, somewhere you perhaps even, had anticipated going, but it sounds as though it was a place that really has defined you.
I mean, to be honest, I wasn't in the best shape when I arrived, but I was, but and then I kind of, and also learning a foreign language from scratch in my first year, I didn't spend as much time on it as I should have done, and I ended up failing one of my part one exams. But I revised really hard for the retake, and because I thought I'm going to miss out on a really fantastic opportunity. And so I passed the retake, and I worked really hard, especially in my final year and in Sweden on my Swedish. And Lampeter was amazing. I mentioned the union. I'm sure a lot of other people have mentioned the union in your interviews. And it's like I've been to clubs. I travelled quite extensively around the world in my 20s and 30s, and I've been to clubs in various cities around the world, and very few match the atmosphere of a Wednesday night, Friday or Saturday night in a union in Lampeter with like a queue coming around it, past the door, past the window.
You're right, because the motivations, and I mean, looking back, I mean, at the time, obviously, you knew you wanted to stay, and you knew that this was the right sort of thing for you. But when you sort of add on 30 years, and you sort of go back to that moment when you'd got there, you perhaps when you arrived, it wasn't somewhere that you'd expected. You had no idea, perhaps, if you'd even like it there. But something, obviously, some magic was obviously done the magic was weaved or woven in that first year. And you really wanted to stay. But when you sort of look back and try and process that kind of period, does it sort of, was there something about Lampeter that was specific about the place? Or was it, would you, do you think it was the fact that you were at university, you wanted to do something. Or is there something particular about Lampeter that was the appeal? Because so many people that I've spoken to who've written about Lampeter sort of say, particularly people who've traveled from America, people who've sort of gone a very long way to study yes. there, they say that yes. it's a place like no other. And it sort of
it isn't.
This works some kind of, you know, power over you, and it never quite lets go.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned University College London. That would have been my second choice. That was my second choice. And that would have been a totally different experience studying. I probably would have studied Danish in London. Mm-hmm. So, but no, when I visited Lampeter, I thought it's lovely, banging uni, surrounded by a lovely countryside. And I went for a lot of walks, particularly my second year when I lived out in the sticks in my second year in a farmhouse called Algochris with my five best friends. And because we didn't have any neighbours, we had parties every month. But Lampeter was, it's very special. As you said, it's not like any other place I know. And it was the smallest university in Western Europe. That was kind of one of its claim to fames. And I enjoyed the course. I did say that I worked hard on my switch to my second year. It was kind of, no, that's a lie. I didn't. But I did work hard on the part one retake exam. But learning, because I love languages, and learning a language from scratch was great. And I did, when I was in Sweden, I worked very hard on my Swedish. But Lampeter's amazing. Actually, there's a couple of people from my hometown who went there as well. And one of the girls was doing Swedish, and she transferred to UEA, and they sent her. She was a first year when I was a second year, and they sent her to Linköping in her second year. And I'd never met her before. And she said to one of the other guys who was studying French, that's Henry Jefferson. I knew his sisters. I went to school with his sisters. That was a bit scary.
Yeah, and the way in which, even though it's a very, very small place, tend, with very big people in a way. Not, I don't know, in terms of their sort of stature and their personality. but you find them in all sorts of places. And, sometimes even where I work here at Kent, there's somebody who I think actually may have done, I'm not sure if it was Swedish, may have been our Swedish in archaeology. And she was there in the early 90s as well. And you do find that. And it's that notion, I think, of counterpoint, because as you say, it was the smallest university in Western Europe, but that doesn't mean to say that you have a diminished experience. And because you can go to the biggest university, but probably feel very, I could imagine if I'd gone to a very big university, I would probably felt quite lonely and quite sort of detached. And I sort of wouldn't have necessarily sort of felt part of the experience, but in going to a small place, it was a lot easier, I think, particularly if you're, depending on your personality, I suppose I've done a lot of thinking about the sort of personality that would gravitate to a sort of place that maybe a lot of other people that you go to school with wouldn't have touched. And often, they wouldn't have chosen somewhere like Lampeter because they were more interested in going maybe for a more city experience.
Yes.
But I as I sort of look back, I don't sort of think, oh, I wish I had gone somewhere else. I kind of feel that, not least because of the size of the place, the impact was huge. And the legacy, I think, has endured, not least
absolutely.
One of the reasons I go to the annual reunions after all these decades.
Yeah, it's quite a place, and I mean, I suppose that I didn't really need that high grades to get in, so I think I needed like 10 points, and with a C in French, and I was never going to get a C in French. But I love coming back as well. I mean, I went to, me and some of my friends who you met the reunion. We used to have an unofficial reunion a couple of times in the noughties and tens, and that was the first time I've been back in like 10, 11 years. And I love going back, and it's a totally different experience from a city experience. I mean, I'm from a small town, and I mean, going to UCL in London would have been a totally different experience. It probably would have been enjoyable, but I mean, it would have been harder to meet people, because in Lampeter, everybody knows everybody, don't they? So, and I'm going to mention the union again. If you're going to go down the union, you didn't have to arrange to meet up with somebody, because there'd be like 20, 30 people there you would know.
Yeah, and that was, you're right about that, because it's the sort of place that we didn't have mobile phones.
No.
You didn't need mobile phones, because you always, you were destined. It was like some sort of, you're destined to see the same people 7 times every day. And I joked about that. But when I was back at the reunion, I was aware that I was seeing the same people sort of like 7 times a day. And I thought, this is exactly what it was like 30 years ago. You don't need to text people. You don't need to make an arrangement to meet them. And I'm talking about now, because you just know you're going to see them in the same places. So there was something quite remarkable about that. So you went from a small town to a small town. Do you want to say a bit more about growing up as you did in the small town in Norfolk. What are your particular memories from growing up there?
Well, not the best. Yeah, I wasn't that popular at school, and I decided we have a big connections to Lord Horatio Nelson, because he was born in Norfolk. He came from North Norfolk, and he went to school in Paston, which used to be a boys' school in North Horsham, where I'm from, and then turned into a sixth form college. And I knew all the people who gave me a hard time at school were going to go there, so I thought I'd go to Great Yarmouth College on the coast instead. So and I was a bit down and depressed and for various reasons, and I was when it came to Lambton. I wasn't the nicest person, you know, to be around, but no, I mean, now I'm back in North Horsham. I've lived away from North Horsham many times, Chris, and appreciate it a lot more now that I no longer live there. But when I was 18, I absolutely hated the place. Maybe you hated where you were from when you were 18. I don't know. A lot of people probably did. But now, I mean, I worked in customer services in Belfast for 8 years, and I've done TEFL teaching, and I've done various things, lived away from North Horsham. And now I think it's lovely. And I can, lots of people moved to North Horsham from other parts of the country, like my parents did in the 70s. So I can understand why people want to live here now. But no, I'm North Horsham born and bred. I was born at the Cottage Hospital when they still had a maternity unit.
you've hit the nail on the head, I think, there, because although I came from the city, I came from the suburbs of Cardiff. And I think it sometimes requires leave. It's a bit like the Wizard of Oz story, I suppose, in that sense, or even Barbie, which is out at the moment. But it's that sort of notion you need to leave the world that is familiar.
Yes.
In order to experience something, and then take something of that new experience back with you into the commonplace, because
absolutely,
I fell in love with Lampeter for sure, but I've always had a bit of a, I wouldn't even call it love hate, relationship with Cardiff, because I'm from Cardiff, but there is that issue of belonging, and now, although I was born there, and although I am Welsh and I went to a university in Wales, I strangely feel more Welsh when I'm in somewhere like Canterbury than I do in Wales. And maybe because I don't sound very Welsh. You need to go away from somewhere sometimes just to assess exactly what is right. And I think that's one of the, I mean, a lot of students that I teach now are working from home or living at home, and they don't have the sort of campus-based university experience that we did all those decades ago. But I suppose in your case, to go from a small town to another small town, albeit culturally quite different, did you find that was something that it took, that it was easier or harder to adjust to?
I was thinking it was quite easy to adjust to. One of the things I noticed, because you go to Lambton and you meet people from other countries and other parts of the country, and you hear all these lovely accents that you haven't really heard much before. So, yes, it wasn't that much of a culture shock. It was just... I mean, I was very relieved that they let me in, to be honest. I mean, I did meet lots of good friends in my first term, some of whom I'm still in touch with. But I won't go into it, but I was quite ill at the time. And if I hadn't gone into Lambton, I don't know what I would have done, to be honest. Maybe I could have taken a year out and applied next year or retaken some of my A-levels. But no, Lambton is, it wasn't really a culture shock. It was just it was different, you know, a lovely scenery, you know, looking at my room in Lloyd Tom, you see like Magic Mountain, all this. But no, it's that wasn't that much of a culture shock. It was just, studying something I really enjoyed, not that I did that much work on, but I did more work on the essays, because I never had to write like 1,500 word essays before. So that took a bit of practice.
Yeah. No, and I'm thinking as well, because you mentioned gigs earlier. Now, in a small town, did you have to travel maybe to Norwich in order to find gigs? You know, or was that something that you did? Because I didn't in Cardiff, even though I was in Cardiff, I don't think I ever went to any gigs, anything like that. And I was a huge radio person. I'm sure we'll probably come on to that sort of thing a bit later on. But in your case, did you find, as I did when it came to cinemas in Lampeter, I had to travel the extra mile, literally, and add on 50 on, you know, 50 in order to do something that I really fell in love with. Now, before you went to university, when you were growing up, did things like the music scene really appeal? Was music kind of your thing?
It was, absolutely, and it still is, Chris. The first gig I ever went to, do you remember Bad News? You know, the young ones did the comic strip thing. And they formed a spoof heavy metal band, and actually played at Donington one year. And the year after, they released an album, and it went straight in at 69 and then straight out again. And they did a version of the Bohemian Rhapsody, and they got on Terry Wogan's chat show. It was really, really funny. you should Google it and or YouTube it. But and then they did a tour and they played at the University of East Anglia Norwich. And I was 12 and my sister Polly was 16 and she had a spare ticket. And so I went. So I went to saw my first gig when I was 12. And it was very, very funny. But the first big gig I went to, but you were right. I mean, my sister, she was 4 years older. She went to more gigs than I did. And she usually had to go to London like I did. Like the first big gig was Def Leppard at Earls Court in London in 92. And I've seen them recently. You may have seen on Messenger. When I was at college, when I was 6 in college, I didn't have much money to go to gigs. So that was in one of the biggest gig I went to for a few years. But I saw lots of gigs at Lambda, all the kind of semi-famous gigs, all the unknown gigs. I went to all of them, and I play guitar and sing, and I play bass. I've been in a few bands, not for a while though. And I have played a couple of rag shows at Lambda, Chris.
Oh yes, yeah. So okay. It sounds like there's a few stories there. I will make sure I come back to that. But I was just thinking, you mentioned Def Leppard. No, see, this is funny because we're recording this on a Tuesday morning, and as I was driving in this morning, I was actually listening to Radio 2, and they
Yeah.
were talking about Def Leppard because
Oh.
they you know they're very much out of the moment. They seem to be doing really really well, and they're
Yes.
very much, I think making new music. They recently did something with the BBC, one of the BBC orchestras.
Yes.
Which was done on Vernon Kay Show on Radio 2. And he was just
Yes.
talking about them and saying how nice they were and all the rest of it. But this is the key thing, isn't it? Because those artists that you see first time round, you went in the 80s, they're still going. Now, do you go to do you follow those bands sort of from your childhood, or is it more sort of new music that you'd be interested in?
Ooh, to be honest, it's more old stuff. I mean, my favorite band since the 90s has been the Manics, Manic Street Preachers. I've seen them 6 times, and I've got Def Leppard were my favorite band when I was a teenager. And I remember when their album Adrenalize came out. It was like a they had their fa one of the guitarists passed away, and they spent a long time recording it. And I remember going to Prism Leisure record shop in Great Yarmouth at like 12 o'clock after my lectures to buy Adrenalize, their new album. On the day it came out, I was that kind of fan.
Oh
But
yeah. No, I can utterly relate to that. I mean, if you're, you have to. The idea of it being released, and no, because these days it's too easy because you can stream it, just press a button. But in those days, it was the pilgrimage element. If you wanted that, you waited till that Monday morning when the shops would open. Often Monday morning, if there was a new, they'd often do it with videos. But what's some places would open at 8 o'clock on a Monday morning, so you could buy it on your way to school or work.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I'm still, I mean, I've seen when I was living in Belfast, I mean, lots of bands play Belfast. It's great. And I saw the Chili Peppers there. I saw Foo Fighters in Belfast. I saw Green Day. And I saw, what's his name? I got Men of Work's Greatest Hits a few years ago. And I went to see Colin Hay, who was the lead singer. And he was really, really, really funny. Really funny. He hasn't got an Australian accent anymore. He's from Scotland originally, and he's got a Scottish accent back.
I always wondered because they were, I don't know if they were a one hit wonder. Obviously, their Down Under was obviously their big hit, but that's the only thing I associate with them. So their lead singer, he was Scottish.
I think the rest of the band were Australian, but he and his family emigrated. I think they were 10-pound Poms in the, I imagine, in the 60s or 70s. And they were massive in America. They're one of the few bands or artists to have number ones at that time, to have number ones in the UK and American singles and album charts at the same time. Because
Yeah.
when Down Under got to number one in both countries, then the album business as usual got to number one as well. So, but he was so funny. I'm not, some of the things he said were quite rude, so I won't repeat them, but he was really, really funny. So, if you ever, he's still releasing solo stuff. Colin Hay is his name. So, if you ever get to see him, he usually plays like little clubs these days. But, no, I'm usually into, older music. I mean, there's bands like Royal Blood who are pretty good, who are now around now. And still, I mean, I like Noel Gallagher stuff and Liam Gallagher stuff that he puts out now, but it's mainly the bands who have been, or artists have been around for a while.
Yeah. Have you ever had any contact with any of the artists themselves? Because I say that because when I, before we had social media, so, growing up, because we're obviously sort of similar-ish age, I remember sort of very early 80s that if you wanted to have any kind of connection with the band, because you couldn't look them up, in the same way now, you couldn't sort of work out, you'd read about them in Smash Hits magazine and all the rest of it. But what you would do, there'd be these fan clubs, which are often run by in, you know, young fans in many cases. So, you know, because I remember through various magazines at the time, you know, you'd subscribe and you'd get lots of posters and stickers, and you'd get maybe a couple of albums or singles and that kind of thing. And but in those days, if you wanted to have a connection with the artist, you might get a signature, sign something from them.
Right.
You'd have to do it through those designated fan sites. But these days, I don't know whether it's easier. In some ways, I guess it is. It depends on the artist and sort of how many sort of agents they have, you know, around them, blocking them potentially from their fans. But have you kind of established any kind of rapport? You mentioned obviously with the lead singer from Men at Work, you have done. But are there any artists like that you've had any kind of interaction with?
No, unfortunately not. But I did. Tori Amos, when I don't know if she still does, but when she was at a commercial peak in about 94 to 96. Some of her fans wrote a fanzine called Take to the Sky, and I subscribed to that for a few years. And when I was in Linköping, it got sent to my Lampeter cubbyhole. But luckily, one of my friends who studied French and Swedish, who was at Linköping with me, one of his friends, her name was Jones and my name was Jefferson, so it came in her cubbyhole, so she would send it to me, bless her. Yeah, but I think the leader of the Institute of the Manics once said, "All right, Henry," but I was quite ill and paranoid at the time, so he might have been hearing things. But yeah, that was at Wembley Arena in 98 when they were mad. That's when This Is My Truth, Tell Me Yours had just come out, and they were huge. And Catatonia was supporting them. It was a great gig.
No, that sounds like seismic then, if they were if
they had a couple of top 10 hits themselves that year. Yeah,
I like that idea though, because I mean, obviously you've got the passion of the artist, but also the passion of fans. And there's that big thing. And I was talking about this with a colleague yesterday about what happens when you meet your idols sometimes and whether it's a good thing. Because I've been in that position of meeting people in the film work sometimes. And you sometimes come away, sometimes maybe a little ambivalent and just think, oh, is it good that I met them? Because you've got the idea of them, that you watch them, their body of work for which they're.
And maybe the idea doesn't match up to the reality.
Yeah. And then what happens when it doesn't? Do you then sort of go back over your past and think, "Oh, actually, maybe I misplaced my fandoms and my obsessions." But you know, so maybe in some ways it's not a bad thing that you haven't necessarily met everybody.
I saw Nick Cave at Heathrow Airport when I was flying back to Sweden in January 96. And who else? Andy Peters, the TV Kids presenter. I saw he was going on a flight to Barcelona. I saw on where his gate he was waiting in, but I've seen somebody, David Baddiel, I saw in a pub in Kent actually in Faversham, and who else have I seen somebody recently? The former Archbishop of Canterbury, he's right on his venerable Rowan Williams, of course. We saw him at the reunion.
Yeah, that was an interesting moment as well, actually, because a colleague of mine who I interviewed for this podcast just a few weeks ago spent a week with him on, I think, in Iona, maybe actually just a few weeks ago,
cool.
Like a week before we saw him at the reunion. But it was ever so slightly surreal. You're right.
To be
having him at what was effectively an AGM, you know, it was a business committee, and then sitting in the corner is one of the most, you know, well-known people in the world, frankly, certainly in the
AGM community.
I was just thinking, Henry, because you've been talking about music and even identifying chart positions in some cases. Now, as you'll know from hearing my other interviews, this was a really big deal for me. And we mentioned Andy White a moment ago. And when he was in my office, he remembered that way back in, it would have been probably my very first term at Lampeter, he remembered that I had a book in which I'd, you know, previously when I was at school, used to write down all the chart positions using the
We have something in common, Chris, because I used to buy the Guinness Book of British Singles. And when I was in Lampeter, do you remember there's Hags Records, and on the other side of the road there's a record shop selling like stationery, like selling like new releases.
Yeah,
the studio. I can't remember the lady who ran it, but she ordered Music Week, the music magazine, every week. So I would go in and I would go and look at the charts, the top 75 singles and album charts, because I was very square. I know far too much about music.
So they had the top. So they put the top 75 out every
in the magazine, Music Week, the Music Industry magazine. And she was very patient. I didn't buy that many tapes or CDs. It was tapes because I didn't have a CD player at the time. But I didn't buy that many tapes from her, and she was quite patient. But one day she said, "Oh, would you like to buy something?" And I think I remember buying The Holy Bible by the Manics, their third really, really, really dark album. But that's my favorite album of all time now, because I knew, because I don't know if you've heard it, but I knew, as soon as, because at the time James Dean Bradfield was interviewed by Q Magazine, and he says, "Yeah, we know it wasn't exactly the most commercial record we could have made, but we're still in love with the idea of the Beatles kissing the tarmac at JFK. We're still in love with the word million." And I thought, and I heard, and I thought, "You're going to be massive." A couple of years ago, they were. A couple of years later, they were.
Yeah, and that's the important thing, isn't it? Because it's great to have all those sort of retro bands and sort of you mentioned Doctor and the Medics, but also meeting those artists or finding those artists when they're kind of on the way up and maybe no one else is promoting them. And I got a colleague here at work with, is it Wet Leg, who are really at
Yes.
the moment sort of he sort of was one of the first to start championing them, and he said there was a gig in a ridiculously small venue in Margate, and I was
Right.
unfortunately that evening I had other commitments, but he was like, "They're going to be big, they're going to be massive, you heard it here first." So I was like, this could be the moment, get that autograph, get those selfies, and they could be worth a lot. But
They're riding the crest at the moment, aren't they? Really, really big. And they supported Harry Styles in stadiums.
and you've already mentioned the way that you had the Manics and you had the Stereophonics, appearing in the same set. But so tell me a bit more then about the chart interest. So was this something that started when you were at school? Is it something were you so?
Yeah. I've got two older sisters and no brothers, or younger sisters. And my elder sister, she got me into music. I think my mother was very into classical music, but my sister insisted on watching Top of the Pops when she was like 4 or 5. So when I came along, we used to watch Top of the Pops quite regularly. And then I remember listening to Cars by Gary Numan on the radio when I was about four and a half, and Blondie and Shawty Wadi and all this stuff, ABBA, and Police, who I thought were Swedish because they all had bleached blonde hair. But no, I've always been into music, and I play guitar from a young age, classical guitar. And when I went to Lambton, I taught myself how to play electric guitar. But yeah, I was hugely into music. I always have been, Chris. I was also into football when I was a kid. I supported Liverpool in the 80s when they were winning everything. I was a glory hunter.
Yeah.
But no, I suppose I bought my first album. It was Humans Live by Howard Jones, because Howard Jones was the first pop star I really got into. And I got that like a few hours after a few years after we stopped selling records. But that was my first, I think, album I ever bought when I was 12. And I had albums for Christmas and presents before then, but that was when I first actually bought with my own money, I think. But now I've, and I think I discovered the Guinness Book of British Singles through my music teacher at school. He was a lovely guy called Mr. Turner, very nice guy, and he had an edition. So I thought, ooh, and then so I think I bought a few over the years. But I think they stopped making them because I think the charts became quite boring, because all the most of the new entries would go down like 20 places the next week,
Oh, they, do you
and
know?
most number ones went into number one in the 90s and the noughties.
Yeah, because they did this, didn't they? And I think, and I'm not, this is not me speaking as an authority on this, but I think it was when I went to a Nuance conference at Lampeter, so that would have been in January 1991, just before the Gulf War. I think there was an Iron Maiden song that went straight to number one.
Yes, I bought it.
Now, and the thing about that, this is what I heard at the time, this is a distorted memory 30 odd years on, is that it was only going to be out in the shops for a limited period of just a couple of weeks, which almost guaranteed that it was going to go straight to the top of the charts, because it wasn't as though, cumulatively you could get it the following week. So but that was a rare thing back then. But you're right, within a decade or so, you'd have this kind of thing going on where songs were entering the charts at top positions rather than working their way up, magically. I mean, the one of the first number ones when I was at secondary school was Jim Diamond, "I Should Have Known Better," and it
I
entered
remember
the chart
that.
at number 40. I think the Bangles' "Eternal Flame" did the same,
Yeah,
and worked its way up slowly, cumulatively, to number one, and then made its way down in the normal way. But have a song that rockets in at number one and then disappears completely. If somebody who, like me, and obviously like you, then takes the charts very, or took, because I don't follow it anymore now, but ancient charts I do, the chart from that era I do through Pick of the Pops and so on.
yeah.
But if you take it seriously, And then you have this sort of gerrymandering of the charts, and you know, ways of almost like guaranteeing that songs would be number one because there are all these, you know, duplicitous, you know, practices going on.
Yeah.
And then it took away the magic of the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I stopped listening to the charts in the '90s, I think, because I used to listen to it on a Sunday, 4:30 to 7 every Sunday on my own. It was great. I think these days, I'm because it's all streaming. I think it's I don't know if it's the same as it was, but I think the songs actually go up the charts these days, and some songs stay in the charts for. I mean, I think Mr. Brightside's been in the charts for a couple of years, so which is better. You know, I mean. Yeah, I bought the Armaid Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter. I bought that the day before it went down to number 9.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah. So did you think you influenced the chart position there?
I think I did, yeah. Nobody else wanted to buy it because I bought it. So. And yeah. I remember it went into number 1 because it was released on like the 23rd of December, so before Christmas. And of course, Saviour's Day by Cliff Richard was number 1. But of course, it would go down the charts because it was a Christmas record after Christmas. And I think Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter sold about 44,000 in his first week, and maybe a similar amount in the second week. So I think it's very impressive to actually stay for 2 weeks. I think our men were probably quite surprised, but then we went down to number 9, and nobody was surprised, really.
Yeah.
And then we went down to number 32 and then to 68, I think.
Oh, I love the way that you know all the positions because
it's very sad.
Well, no, but I used to have different sort of color coding for the charts, and
oh, you know, cool.
I'd write them all down. Of course, I mean, now we've got the internet. You see, that's the thing as well, because these days, if you want to authenticate something, corroborate something, just to find something out, you know, you can easily get that kind of information.
Yes.
But back
yes.
then, it was precious listening to it on the radio at 5 o'clock, as it was, and then it. I know the program got a bit longer, but you'd listen to it on a Sunday evening, and it kind of mattered, and it certainly mattered in terms of validation in the school playground.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
I mean, did you find that was happening, that you'd be in school and sort of comparing, and you know, everybody would listen, and there'd always be that, you know, if your favorite record had gone up or somebody else's favorite record had gone down, then there was kind of, I'm not going to say the gloating maybe, but it was the sense in which it mattered. It's like football, because I've never been really into football, but it's the same right. thing. If somebody else's team is going down in the Premiership, and you know, then in a way you're affixing your, you know, your colors to that mast.
Yeah, I mean, I knew a few people who listened to the charts, maybe not as much as I did, but I think when the Armaid song went down to number 9, I think people went, ah, or something. But before we forget, it doesn't have anything to do with Lampeter, but I want to mention that I got to see U2 in Cape Town, South Africa when I was travelling there.
How did that happen? Were you there coincidentally, or did you go all the way there?
Coincidentally, because after I finished my Swedish degree, some of the other people on my course wanted to do a master's in commercial translation at the University of Surrey. One of our lecturers in our final year, she studied on the course, and she taught on the course in Surrey, and she told us all about it. So some of us did it the same year, the next year, and I thought, well, I want to go travelling. So I saved up enough money to go travelling. I've worked lots of local factories around North Horsham, and I thought, well, I want to get. I thought about getting like a round the world ticket, but then it would have taken me more time to save up enough money. So I thought I'll just concentrate on one place. So I went to Southern Africa, and I decided to go to Southern Africa, bought all the Lonely Planet and all the Rough Guides and everything. And did my research. And then I went to, I was flying from Johannesburg to Cape Town on the Friday, reading the local paper. And I was reading that you two were going to be in Cape Town on the Monday. And that's where I was going to be in Cape Town for a few weeks. And I thought, oh, you two, amazing. And then I thought, well, you two gigs sell out so quickly in Europe. But I thought, well, there's no harm in going to the ticket office and trying to get a ticket. And I got a ticket. And there's a couple from the Netherlands who were staying at the same hostel as me. And they'd seen you two in the Netherlands before. And they were able to get tickets on the door. And I remember we were all fit for firearms because South Africa is quite a dangerous place. But it was amazing, Chris. Absolutely amazing. And you had like Table Mountain in the background. It was like late summer, you know, 30 degrees and sunshine. It was beautiful.
Yeah. By the sound of it, that's one of the gigs that you would...
That's the best gig I've ever been to, yeah.
And I suppose there is this sort of thing as well, because we've been talking about how... it's easy to follow artists, you know, over the years. But in your own case, so tell me a bit about what you're doing in your life now.
I'm a freelance literary translator. I've done loads of things, as I've said, and I came back from Belfast at the start of the first lockdown to try and make it as a full-time literary translator. And if you want to get into that field, you contact like literary agencies and you try and do samples or book readers' reports and that kind of stuff. And what I do, Chris, is a bit like being a jobbing actor. It's like, you know, it's either lots of work or no work at all. And I've had a fair bit of work earlier this year, but it's gone a bit quiet because Sweden kind of shuts down during the summer. But I thought I'd write to the lady who, the agency who's given me most paid work. And I wrote to her yesterday, and she said, we'll always keep you in mind. So she always sends me work. It's just a matter of when, question of when. But so I am, after I left Lambton, I went traveling. And then 1 year turned into, the gap year turned into two. And then I ended up doing the master's in translation in the University in Guildford in 1999-2000. And then since then, I've worked as an in-house translator, a commercial translator, worked as a freelance commercial translator, done some factory work, done some TEFL teaching, which I was terrible at. But I went into it more for the travelling rather than the actual teaching.
So travelling is a big thing for you, but also
yes,
in lockdown,
yes.
You know, you couldn't travel, but you managed to find something else that you were able to sort
exactly,
of
yeah, I did.
Harness.
I did quite a few, a number of like unpaid translations, sample translations, because I needed the practice. And it was, I wasn't going to go anywhere, like April, May 2020. So I did all these sample translations. And then I started doing paid translations later on that year. But one thing I should say, would like to mention is, after I came back from South Africa, I applied for the MA course in Guildford for 1998-99. And I hadn't used my Swedish for a year. I had to do a test translation, and my Swedish was really rusty. So I failed the test translation. And they said, the people at the University of Surrey said, we suggest you work on your Swedish before coming back to us. So I thought, right, best way of going working my Swedish is to going to Sweden. So a couple of months later, I went to Harwich, got there, armed with my debit card and my passport. And I got the ferry to Gothenburg, and then I stayed on the floor of somebody who's doing Swedish Lambda, who's he was in his year abroad in Gothenburg at the time. So I stayed with him, and I went to Stockholm, stayed in all these youth hostels, and I found a page of the Swedish equivalent of the Yellow Pages, and I thought I'll go into the translator section. I'll work myself down a list and see if any of these translators need like an assistant. And the first three said no, and the fourth one said it was a lady called Claire James, and she said, yeah, I could do some help. So I worked for her for a few months, and I house sat when she finally went to the Cayman Islands, and she wrote me a reference, and it was that reference which got me on the MA for the next year, 1999-2000.
Yeah, it's lovely how these things work out, and I guess at the time you just don't know what's around the corner, but
no,
looking
no.
back, you almost see a pattern. Like you were destined to do this. You had to do this.
Yeah, I should explain just the difference between literary and commercial translation. Commercial translation is like the technical stuff or legal stuff, and literary as well, yeah, fiction, non-fiction. And I was in one of my lecturers at Lambda, the late Laurie Thompson, Dr. Laurie Thompson. He retired actually soon after we left because the language departments all closed down in about 1999. So he and his wife Birgitta they retired, and he became a full-time literary translator, but he was like a part-time and literary translator, part-time lecturer when we were at Lambton. He said, don't go into literary translation. So I should have done, because I enjoy it a lot more than I did the commercial stuff.
The thing is, different eras as well, because in one particular era, somebody might say, you know, don't go down this path because you're not going to get you much work. But,
yeah.
You know, with the internet, with all the opportunity, travel opportunities, and
yes.
Also what happened during lockdown when people couldn't
yeah.
travel, you sort of, you never quite know. I mean, the skill set that people have can be stored up. I mean, I've never done radio as such, but I guess doing a podcast kind of is a radio type thing. So it's,
yeah.
So in a way, you kind of feel that, if there's something that you really want to do, you'll find your own bespoke way of doing it rather than what may not have worked out for somebody a generation or two back.
Yeah. I mean, I know there's more. I mean, I'm hoping... I translated my first complete book with a mentor last year, and I'm hoping to get more books. And then, I mean, I met up years ago when I was thinking about going into it, but when I was still working in Belfast, sorry, I met up with this guy who was living in Beccles in Norfolk, and we met up, and he's a very successful freelance translator, and he gave me lots of good advice, and he kind of, a lot of translators, they do something else, or they do both commercial and literary, or they do another job, and he's just a full-time literary translator, so that's kind of what I'm aspiring to do, just do it all the time. But I'm thinking about getting like a part-time temping office job just to keep the wolf from the door in between translation jobs.
Is this something that you always knew that you wanted to do, or is it something through experience that you realised that you were quite good at?
Well, I was good at languages, and I remember I was when I was doing my French A level in Great Yarmouth, my French teacher said, "Oh, you could do translate Danish. You could translate Danish." And I didn't think, I thought, okay, yeah, you know, in the future. And I thought, I didn't think much of it. And then but I really started thinking about it in my final year when Rachel Owens from Guildford came up and taught. She started up an agency in Tregaron with her husband, which is a translation agency. And she would come and teach us like Danish and Norwegian modules. And she told us all about the course. And I thought, oh, and then I thought, well, I'll maybe in a year or two, but I want to go traveling. So, but, and then I thought, and then, you know, when I did go to Sweden to seek my fortune, I thought, yeah, why not? And then Claire James's reference was really, really complimentary. I think she said, am I being fair, Henry? And I said, I think you're being a bit too fair, Claire, to be honest. But I hope she doesn't mind me mentioning her name. I hope she's still around. She'd be in her 70s now. I mean, some degrees and courses and qualifications are quite occupation specific, aren't they? And I suppose with the Swedish degree, I thought, well, I can either teach or translate, and I've kind of done both. Not teaching Swedish, but I've taught teaching English. So, and there's not much else I could have done with it unless I did something completely different. And when I was living in Belfast, I was using my Swedish at the call centre, the customer service place, and so I still got to use my Swedish. I was mainly like the last contract I was in for this company was the company Mondelez who owned Cadbury's, and we were getting letters from Swedish customers about their chocolate, and I would you know write to them, you know I would answer their calls and then pass them on to the Swedish agents on the floor, because when I was in Belfast, it was really cool, Chris, because I was working with people from all over the world. There's a guy from Costa Rica. There's lots of Swedes, French people, Germans. A couple of nice ladies from Argentina. It was really nice, good, because they never, Concentric, the company, never had a problem with recruiting from outside Northern Ireland, because a lot of people, if they got the opportunity to live abroad, they jumped at the chance.
No, and I was just thinking as well, because you talk earlier about the small town element, both in terms of where you grew up and also going to university. But it also sounds as though that's given you the gateway into this whole world of meeting people from so many different cultures, because I'll speak for where you grew up in Norwich area, but certainly in Lampeter, the world came to Lampeter. It felt a very strangely, hybrid of very sort of local provincial, but also very cosmopolitan at the same time.
There's a few people from Sweden, which is great for us, and lots of people from South Wales, of course, and from Southern England, like around Portsmouth area, maybe Southampton, a lot of people from Southwest England, and two of my best friends are from, as you met Scott. He's from Sheffield, another friend's from Stone in Staffordshire. So they didn't have as far to go as I did. But
That's true.
it would sometimes take like 14 hours to get from North Norfolk to Lampeter, Chris. Because the coaches at the Victoria Coast Station would never connect. So there would always be like a 3 hour wait from between well, on the way there anyway, between the coaches from Norwich to London and then the coach from London to West Wales. Yeah, I mean, I think because my parents met in New Zealand of all places. My father was a merchant seaman, and he, I think, and my sister, my sister, my mother went to Australia and New Zealand in the 60s with a best friend at the same time when a lot of people were emigrating to that part of the world. But they were always going to come back, and my mother was she was teaching, she was working away around New Zealand with a friend, and then she was in this place, she was in this hotel in Queenstown, in the south on South Island in the mountains. And she was working in a hotel, and my father, his boat was docked in Dunedin on the south coast of the South Island. And I think he and his few of his crewmates had a few days R&R, so they went up to Queenstown for a few days rest, and they ended up staying in the hotel where my mother was working. And then my mother's best friend introduced them. So if it hadn't been for New Zealand or my mother's best friend, I wouldn't be here.
And I find, I mean, in so many families, in my case, because if it hadn't been for the Second World War, my grandparents would never have met, because they would have both married people in their own towns, their own villages. My grandmother was from Cardiff, but my grandfather was from Worcester, and he moved to Cardiff after they met in the war, and then and lived there until he died in his mid-90s.
Oh,
So
fantastic.
all those random kind of sort of things, completely accidental, and then
Sliding doors kind of thing.
It is. There's so much of that. As we start to wrap up, Henry, just sort of thinking, one of the questions I always ask at this point is whether, looking back, you'd say that your memories, as you look back on your life and career, are predominantly positive ones.
I wasn't going to mention this, but I was diagnosed with a mental health condition about 20 years ago, and but I'm much better now. I'm on medication, but I mean, I've traveled extensively. I've got, a couple of degrees. I've done all right. Okay. Sometimes I had to do factory work, but there's nothing else. But people in factories are sort of their people, lovely people. So when I look back at my life, I was looking at my photo album the other day. And I was looking at photos of me and my friends in Lampeter, and then when I was traveling, and I've been like five or six once in a lifetime kind of trips. So, and I'm hoping to go to Antarctica next year to celebrate my 50th, if this work still comes in.
Yeah, but also those opportunities. I think I mean I always reflect, and I mean Lampeter. There was a period when I had no contact with anybody in Lampeter really, and I
Okay.
missed the place. I missed the people so much. But I also
Yes.
thought, but also that led to something positive, So it was being in a place that wasn't, I went through a period of not being in the happiest of places in my life, shall we say.
Oh dear.
But it was the knowledge that there was something better once, that I once had it, I lived it, I experienced it. I have
Yeah,
a diary to
yeah.
corroborate that. And in a way, I'm kind of not least through meeting people like you, doing the podcast. It's like recapturing that. And 10 years ago, I could never have anticipated that that luxury would ever come up again. And so it's like turning some of that disappointment or some of that negativity into something quite positive. And it sounds like
Yes.
that's something that has worked for you.
Yes. I mean, I think some people can slag off social media, but I mean, that's me and my friends who you met, who we met up with in Lampeter. I hadn't been in touch with them for years, and then one of them invited me to their wedding, which is great. And then since then, we started going on Facebook or whatever, and they're only like a click away, aren't they? I've got a lot of got in touch with a lot of people through Facebook that I hadn't been in touch with for years. So I mean, some people say it's maybe not the best thing because for various reasons. But no, I mean, no, Lampeter was amazing. It was great, and I'm so pleased. I'm still in touch, like 30 years later, with some people I was at university with. I mean, I don't regret going there for an instant. I mean, as I said, if I hadn't got in, then I probably would have had to. Maybe I would have gone the next year. I don't know if I, you never know.
It is one of those, because in the film Sliding Doors, we get to see both versions of reality. We get to see the two options, but in our case, we have to imagine one of them. Or maybe sometimes we kind of feel that we are living a sort of a parallel life, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think you've touched on something really profound and important there, because what you find through social media is, there may be things about social media that are not great, but the
No.
chance to connect with people who, and this is the crucial bit for me, the people who are not random, they were in our lives, the people that we went to university with. If we had this spark, if we all went to an arts-based university all those years ago, then that says something about who we are. It says something about what motivated us,
Yes.
what grounded us. And fundamentally, for me, one of the great joys is discovering that we may be a bit older, but we are older, but we're not fundamentally different. And
No.
the way that I've picked up conversationally with people, almost as though when I've, like you, been at the reunion, what I see are people who are as they were, they don't look 50, they look 20. And it's interesting what it does, because there's something about the essence of that person
Absolutely.
that has been almost like kind of frozen in time.
Yeah, it's a very weird thing for people. I mean, the group of friends, my friends who I mentioned, Chris, I mean, we've been in touch on and off since about 2007. But some people, I mean, the guy I mentioned who studied French and Swedish, he came to the reunion, well, unofficially last year, and he came again this year. And I hadn't seen him for years. And he looked, as there was me and Scott were in the union, and we thought this guy, I thought, oh, that's so and so. And then the real so and so walked past that second. So he's got a doppelganger, and I hadn't seen him for years. And he went to Linköping with me, and we studied Swedish together for 4 years. So it was great to catch up with him. And he's I've been in touch with him on Facebook, but we kind of lost touch, and then we're kind of in touch. And we both we I don't know if I told you that me and my sister went to see the ABBA Void show recently, and this guy saw it last year. Yeah, another Swedish connection, the ABBA thing. I don't know if you've heard about the ABBA Void show.
I've heard of it, and I know people who've gone to it, and I'm amenable to being persuaded to go. I'm whether I go on my own or with my children, but
Oh, take your children. Take your children.
that sounds phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I got one more question for you, Henry, which is whether you would consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Glass half full, glass half empty. Well, I mean, back in the day, I mean, in some a few years ago, I mean, when I was starting getting into translation or trying to get into literature translation, I was quite naive and I thought, oh yeah, I'll get books straight away, and it kind of took a while. And then, I mean, I didn't look to the future that much because my mother says one of her best pieces of advice is just look 5 minutes ahead, 5 minutes at a time. So I don't know what I'll be doing in a year. Maybe I'll be back in an office or translating my third book. I'm not too sure, but
Or going around Antarctica.
exactly, or just a tiny bit of it. I'm not that choosy. But there is actually a post office on one of the peninsulas where there's a couple of people. They go there during the summer and they live there, and then they when the cruise ships come in, you know, they then you can post a letter from, you know, there's like a post box and like stamps, I think. So you can, I mean, as well as all the scientists, there are actually a few people who work at this post office just in the summer. So I'd love to go there.
And also, of course, I'm guessing that you might have had the taste of the Lampeter reunion, and that might be something that you may also return to in a
Yeah, I mean, I did go last year for the big 200th anniversary, but I went there this year because I knew my friend who I mentioned. And the other friends who you met, I knew they were going, so I thought I need to know a few people. But it was a bit quieter this year. I don't know if you went last year. It was a bit
Yeah,
quiet.
I've been at the last five or so, yeah.
Okay, but no, I'd love to go again. And I'm trying to get some more friends who I mean, there was a thing on the Lampeter Society about why people don't go, and some people think, oh, it's too far. But I mean, I, you know, my friend, he lives in Attleborough, which is just the other side from Norwich. I just get all I'm going to do is get a train from Norwich, Norwich, up Norwich, Attleborough, and we'll drive to Wales together. So that's so maybe, but some people think it's too far or they're too busy. But I would, as I said, a few more people, some of the people I actually lived with in my second year, as I mentioned before, I mean, I think they would like to go. I think they've both got families, but I think they'd like to go in the far. So if I, and as a and the, one of the guys is from my hometown who was, I think he did archaeology and ancient history. I think he was a year below me, but he I knew him from playing guitar years ago, and I tried to get him to come, and maybe he will come. So I don't
Well,
know if I've mentioned too many names, but.
you've made me think of that. It's not one of my favorite films, but Field of Dreams, and there's that famous line there, but if you build it, it will come, or they will come.
Is that the baseball
The
film?
baseball with Kevin Costner, yeah.
Right.
So I feel it about Lampeter that effectively the infrastructure is in place. If you want it to work,
Yeah.
and if you build it up virtually, which is not what Kevin Costner's film was all about. So I'm being a bit loose with my translation, my literary filmic translation there. But then it will happen, and I certainly will. If you go back next year, I will certainly see you there in person,
Oh,
Henry.
fantastic, Chris. Thank you for interviewing me.
Not a problem at all. It's been such a pleasure having you. Thank you for being my guest this week.
Thank you very much.